Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. It's that time of year. Time to check in with the first subject this program spotlighted a decade ago. We're speaking about the annual New York Television Festival, the birthplace of both the independent television movement and the prime forum for it. Festival director Aaron Day joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. This Big Apple also will offer an Emmy-winning composer of animated television a rare public showcase, thanks to Journey to America, coming to Carnegie Hall October 7th. You'll hear the tune for tunes, the leader in Monis, and conductor Amy Anderson next half hour. And an entrepreneur connecting content with smart TV sets and devices wraps up our week. Scott Fisher is the entrepreneur, and his work includes a pair of acclaimed YouTube Red specials. He'll stop in an hour from now. Also ahead, The Walking Dead's creator has a new TV series home, Gypsy Be Gone, our latest TV in My Bones up details, and the answer to this week's classic trivia question. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Blog Talk Radio. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. The program all about television, now in its second decade on the air. And brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the program. Great to have you with us on this Friday afternoon. We wrap up our first week of decade number 2. 80 degrees at the top of the hour here in the Big Apple. We have a very eclectic lineup for you over the next 90 minutes, and we invite you to be in the conversation. It's so simple. Raise your voice, pick up the phone, and dial in at 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number is good anywhere you're catching us across the country, around the world, here on Blog Talk Radio. Our chat room is open for business. That's SimonApple04 by name. You'll find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Get 838 already in the room. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen, follow the instructions, and other people can be live with news. Live with you. There we go. New York Television Festival Director Aaron Day joins me here in the Big Apple after these news notes. Amazon Studios has launched a new campaign to produce a variety of series and miniseries in genre categories. Stage one of that effort, a 2-year programming deal with Robert Kirkman, the creator of The Walking Dead, and his Skybound Entertainment Enterprise. Kirkman will cultivate action-adventure, science fiction, and fantasy series on an exclusive basis for Amazon, bringing to an end a similar arrangement with AMC. According to a Hollywood Reporter item this morning, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos himself called for the genre TV excursion. Another single season effort goes out Netflix's door today. This time it's Gypsy, the Naomi Watts starring series that premiered 2 months ago to bad reviews. Watts also served as an executive producer. And more Christine Knows Best is ahead at USA Network. The popular unscripted family saga will return for its 6th USA season in 2018. But before that, the network will bring Chrisley and crew back for 18 fifth season extending episodes next month, including a two-part Christmas special in December. A new According to Chrisley after show will follow each Knows Best episode, where Todd Chrisley himself will face a live audience, be joined by a member of his family in each episode, or a celebrity guest. And that is news notes for today. The program started on the first Monday of 2007, and our first topic then was a festival that a lot of people around the country did not know about, but it turned out to be the start of a very important movement in television, the independent television movement, a movement where independent producers outside of the studio system or the production company system or the network system had the opportunity to produce pilots that would be seen like a film festival in public, and also be seen behind the scenes by network executives. And who knows what that could lead to. We're talking about the New York Television Festival. And now, more than a decade later, the festival is the linchpin in a whole circuit of festivals all over the country. It's also inspired such film festivals as Sundance are better to do more on television, and that may be still just the beginning. Joining you live here in New York, the director of the New York Television Festival, Aaron Day. Aaron, congratulations. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Simon, and congratulations to you. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. We both have come a long way. And by the way, I want to extend a congratulations to the founder and festival director, Terrence Gray, who cannot be with us today because of something he's handling. And I also want to congratulate Ned Canty, who was the person that took the gamble to be our first guest back on that first Monday of 2007. Wherever you are, Ned, we hope life is doing great for you, and thank you for really making the move to get our show going in great style. Erin, what do you think has been the most important development in this independent movement and in this festival movement over the last decade?
Well, I think, you know, it starts with the number of buyers and the number of outlets for episodic content. You know, that when we started the festival back in 2005 and, you know, when Tomorrow Will Be Televised came on the scene in 2007, TV definitely wasn't yet what it is now. And I think that when you look at the explosion across the digital landscape, across the traditional linear television landscape, that as a motivating component really drove the success and I think the explosion of independent television and buyers and decision makers looking to non-traditional outlets to find talent and series concepts.
What do you think about the fact that here you are on the eve, in a way, of your latest festival, and you have not just this festival circus, but you have new players now like Apple, which just launched its second original series, Carpool Karaoke, earlier this week.
Yep.
And you now have Facebook with Watch. You have YouTube Red. You have YouTube also doing commercial series, original script, episodic series, unscripted and scripted. You have all these players coming in, and you can't go a week without, for example, a new player coming in. On Monday, we had Katie O'Connell Marsh, who was the former GoM on TV. Now she's a new project, a new production studio, Platform One Media, that's funded in part by Liberty Global, the big international cable operator. It's like you can't go a week or even sometimes a day or two without a new player coming in.
Yeah, I think, you know, the video explosion sort of across the digital landscape, whether it's in traditional news or information sites, and then obviously, you know, sort of episodic entertainment, it's vast. It's a little bit still difficult to navigate and know who's going to thrive and who may, you know, issue an effort that isn't as successful. And I think that what we're continuing to see are major corporations and other sort of media companies getting into the space, experimenting. You know, you have AT&T and Verizon and sort of the mobile side of the business. You have, as you mentioned, sort of the global conglomerate media companies that are getting into looking to develop digital-specific content. And then you have the multitude of traditional television properties that are, you know, whether they're launching or they're continuing to cultivate their digital presence. I think that it's exciting. I mean, from a creator standpoint and for, you know, the creative community that we have submitting to the festival every year, it's thrilling because there's a lot of places that want content. There's a lot of places that want niche content. Every decision maker that we talk to talks about the importance of voice and vision and the uniqueness of a creator's sort of overall aesthetic. So on that side, I think it's really thrilling and exciting and represents tremendous opportunity for people, you know, across the sort of creative sphere. And I think, you know, it also comes with a little bit of risk and it comes with a little bit of, you know, gamble in terms of what's going to last and what's going to rise to the top. You mentioned at the top of the show, you know, Netflix issued another cancellation today, and I think we're starting to see not necessarily a contraction, but maybe a less sort of wild, just throwing money at everything approach to content and people being a little bit more selective. But for us, it's thrilling. I think we represent a creative base that, for the most part, operates at a slightly lower price point and is still creating great work. We're announcing our official selections next week, and we have an absolutely stellar lineup of projects that look and feel and I think are ready to be considered by TV and digital decision makers. So I think for the most part, it's really thrilling. And, you know, and as with any innovation comes that little bit of a risk factor, which, you know, makes it exciting.
Do you think that with Netflix, like for every series they're canceling on Gypsy, they're still approving a bunch, as they did earlier this week, David Letterman's new series, the new show from the Coen brothers, this new show from people who worked in Israel. They're doing one show and they're developing a second. Or Amazon with the deal with Robert Kirkman, where apparently under Jeff Bezos' command they said, hey, let's do more genre television. Do you think that that would open up the door not just for the festival people in your neck of the woods, but also the other festivals, that Series Fest in Denver and Northport, Long Island, and ATV in Atlanta, and ATX North in Texas? that those festivals and maybe the festival circuit as a whole can be more effective in terms of bringing the people that they're showcasing a more direct avenue to getting into the industry.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, I think I can sort of speak to what we're doing, and the industry engagement component of NYTVF has long been sort of our calling card, and I think it's one of the things that we do best and is part of the reason, you know, to your point at the top of the show, and we obviously appreciate the sentiment, you know, we've been around the longest, and we continue to sort of welcome the most premieres, and I think, you know, people that are creating independent episodic work, I hope and I believe are looking to us as sort of the premier destination, and that is because we do so much to facilitate engagement between the artists that are selected for the festival and the decision makers and development executives and agents and managers that attend, and creating a system that is, you know, facilitating engagement. It's efficient, it's effective, and it gives creators and their work a real chance to shine. So yeah, I think, you know, when you talk about all of these projects that are being greenlit in the digital space, one thing that's clear is that the need for content and the drive for content that we've seen explode over the last few years seems to be sustaining. And, you know, our job is to be a destination for creatives, be a trusted outlet for their work and their intellectual property, be a curatorial voice in the industry, and, you know, be savvy enough and switch enough to put those two things together. So, yeah, and, you know, in terms of other festivals, I think it's, you know, it's great to see that other people have embraced it, whether it's independent television festivals specifically or larger film festivals that are acknowledging the need in the space. You know, but for us, I think we were there. I think parents, as you noted, really saw a need in the space and in the industry, and we're happy to still be around and you know, looking forward to bringing our 2017 slate to the masses.
And that 2017 slate, year 13 of the New York Television Festival, happens October 23rd to the 27th at various venues here in the greater New York area. We're speaking with Erin Day. She is the festival director, and she joins us live this half hour from the Big Apple on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Tom and Applebaum with you live from New York for the Pro Model About the Tube, now in our second decade. If you have a question or comment for Erin, give us a ring, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. We have guests 8:43 and 8:38 in the room. Monday on our program, we'll meet a rising composer. You may know this person's work from Children's Hospital, the long-running series on Adult Swim, and now he is doing, speaking of Netflix's new miniseries, Wet Hot American Summer, 10 years later. Co-composer Matt Novak will be with us. That's Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Ellen, the official entries are happening next week. How many entries will there be, and how else are people getting involved? I know that last year you started a script contest visiting comedy, and this year it's also happening for drama.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, obviously you'll have to stay tuned to see exactly how many projects we have in competition this year. But I can say that we are seeing tremendous numbers. You know, both our total submission number for the year is up. You know, for the third year in a row, we're seeing an increase in total submission numbers, which is terrific, you know, to continue to see that sustained growth year after year. I think speaks volumes about the number of people that want to be creating for television. You know, and then something that's very important to me, we're seeing the numbers of female creators, female directors. That number went up like 50% this year from last year. You know, diverse persons of color, just bringing, you know, really important points of view and really important voices to the door. And I think that that's a big reason why we've seen this sustained interest from the industry. You know, last year we had 75 companies participate in our NYTVF Connect program. We facilitated close to 600 meetings between participating executives and artists. And next week, when the announcement comes out, you'll see a number of projects from well-known creators and stars, and then you'll see a number of projects from people that this is their first outing in television. So that excitement and sort of, you know, surprise that we continue to see with some of these projects makes it continue to be fun and thrilling. And, you know, the idea that we can help people, whether it's launch their careers or, you know, distribute their passion projects, is a great place for us to be and really sort of the foundational idea of the NYTVS.
Erin, staying with what you just talked about, we just came off a Television Critics Association tour that had more than one panel, maybe for the first time ever, address this issue of the lack of women directors, writers, producers, and women of color especially in television. We're seeing all these ventures again breaking out. Ryan Murphy's Half Initiative, Glenn Mazar has been on our program trying to get at least half of his shows directed by women. Liz Eager-Glider's new project, Female Forward with NBC, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is the festival this year going to make a more concentrated effort beside showcasing the TV pilots to do maybe more things in terms of bringing this topic out in the open here in New York?
Yeah, sure. You know, and I think that we've done that. And you know, my personal philosophy on that in terms of programming the festival, you know, outside of the official selections, looking to the high-level creatives that we invite to speak and the kinds of network and studio shows that are being spotlighted by the festival, I think that first and foremost, we're looking for projects that deserve to be here. And I think what I find to be very heartening, you know, in the last few years as we've really seen our diversity numbers across the board increase, is that this is not a quota or an outward number that we're trying to reach. We're seeing genuine talent and projects that deserve to be in, that deserve to be considered, that happen to come from female creators and happen to be directed by female directors. And I think that that, to me, is indicative that, you know, when the industry is ready to embrace it, we see the talent, that the emerging talent is there. And I think, you know, our biggest hope for the industry that's participating is as, you know, our industry passes are on sale, the early bird rate expires next week. We hope that they'll look at those numbers and recognize that there is a generation of female creators and diverse creators that are ready, that are producing great work, and that, you know, we're thrilled to provide a platform for, you know, at the annual festival.
Any new initiatives that you'll be doing at the festival this year?
You know, we have a new day dedicated to TV writing specifically. We've long done what we call Development Day, which is a public event on sort of the Saturday afternoon of the festival, our closing day. This year we're dedicating an entire track for our official artists and, you know, any festival pass holder. It will be optional for people who register for the festival in that capacity. Very much dedicated to writing and not just, you know, writing an episode or getting staffed in a writer's room, which we think is obviously important, but, you know, having a more broad conversation about what is are important elements for aspiring writers and emerging writers to be thinking about as they start their career. How, you know, has new media and TV binge watching impacted television writing as an art form? You know, hearing from established showrunners and staff writers on ways in which the industry is changing and really providing sort of a toolkit for those type of creators to learn, to network, and to hopefully be empowered to make the next step of their career. So that's something that we're really excited about. It's something that we've often heard from our participants that they would like to focus on, so we are thrilled to be bringing that. And we have a few other tricks up our sleeve that I will let you know about as soon as we're ready to announce it, but it's shaping up to be a really terrific festival, and you know, again, I think that the content for us is sort of the first thing and the most important thing that we focus on, and to be revealing our competition slate for both the produced pilots as well as the scripts next week. It's exceptional work, and I think it speaks to the importance of NYTVF and the independent television movement, and being able to bring those voices and those talents to a larger market is an honor for us.
One of the big breakthroughs you made this year was to establish a festival in Chicago, a two-day festival largely on comedy. How'd that go, and is that coming back next year?
It was terrific. You know, we have long done outreach initiatives in Chicago. Obviously, their artistic community is a step above their comedy community in particular. It's one of the birthplaces of improvised comedy, and you know, look no further than the halls of Saturday Night Live to understand the importance of Chicago in the greater comedy landscape. So we, this year, as you said, decided to go and have a little bit bigger of a footprint. We were approached by a number of our industry partners who knew that we did events there and have long worked to cultivate that audience. And they indicated that they would like to be there and that they would like to be meeting with new talent. So we set a two-day event that we partnered with IO and the Second City, which are the two sort of bastions of comedy in Chicago, and it was a fantastic event. You know, sold out two nights of programming. We facilitated about 150 meetings between Chicago creators and our participating network, studio, and agency representatives. And, you know, in terms of what it yielded, we saw increases across the board in the number of submissions. And one thing that you'll see next week when we announce our official selections is we have more Chicago official selections. So I think by all accounts, it was a successful venture, and we're definitely looking forward to continuing those efforts in the future.
Incidentally, Chicago is, of course, also the home for Dick Wolf's tripod of TV series, Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, et cetera, and Chicago Justice, which only made a half season on NBC this past year. Any possibility that he might get involved and try to extend the Chicago, if you go back to Chicago next year, to maybe also have a dramatic focus?
We would love that, you know, and obviously outside of the episodic content that's being filmed there, the theater community in Chicago is so robust and so lively and important and really an important feeder to both the Broadway and off-Broadway scene. So I think, yeah, you know, given the opportunity to work with people that are more focused on the dramatic side, we would be thrilled. And I think one thing that we found is that, you know, a number of the working actors and writers that we engage with in Chicago are straddling both worlds and are interested in both worlds and are creating content that, you know, isn't necessarily pigeonholed into just one genre. So it's an incredible city, and we were really thrilled to be able to go and to have the support from the Chicago institutions that we had, and are looking forward to, you know, sharing some of these Chicago-based projects with our industry participants at the festival in October.
Erin Day is the director of the New York Television Festival, coming back for its 13th go-around, October 23rd to 27th in the New York metro area. And she's our guest this half hour on Tomorrow We Televised. Simon Applebaum here with you live from the Big Apple, where it's 80 degrees right now. And we invite you to be part of the program. All it takes to bring from you. Give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04. My name is 843, 838, already in the room. Next Friday on the program, we'll have a key executive Travel Channel with us. His name is Neil Regan, and he is also the executive producer of one of the more unique programs coming up later this month. It's called Caribbean Pirate Treasures, and it involves the son of the legendary explorer Jacques Cousteau, Philippe Cousteau. And also, we're going to interview someone whose profession we have never had in this program, one of the great cameramen for news. In this case, a cameraman who spent 40 years on the front lines for ABC News, from the Vietnam War to 9/11. His name is Tony Hiroshiki. We'll speak with him and Terry Irving about a brand new book they have written called On the Front Line of the Television War. And next week we will offer that book as a prize in our classic trivia question contest. That's coming up next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow We Televised. A couple years ago, Erin, you, Terrence, the crew at your festival formed a television production unit. In fact, the first series you did was The Jams, out of Chicago, sort of a workplace fun comedy, got on Netflix. What's the status of that unit?
You know, we're continuing to develop, and we have a number of projects in the pipeline with multiple festival partners. You know, for us, the opportunity to continue to participate and to help foster and guide and shepherd projects through the development process is an honor and something I think that we're good at and that we can bring to the table. So we have, you know, several projects with both digital and network partners that we are continuing to play an active development role in. And, you know, again, hope to have some additional information for you on the status of those projects in the coming months.
Right? One more thing before we go. You have some alumni who are doing a series for the CW this year.
We have some alumni that are doing really great stuff. Yeah, so Richard Keith and Aaron Cardillo, who are on top of being festival alumni, are just fantastic people and fantastic writers. They won our comedy script initiative several years ago. From there, they sold their first project to the CW, a comedy called Significant Mother, which ran a few years ago over the summer. They went from there to executive produce Fuller House on Netflix, and they are debuting their new series with the CW, which is produced by Bill Lawrence from Scrubs. It's called Life Sentence, and it's Lucy Hale's first Pretty Little Liars, post-Pretty Little Liars project. They just did an event for us in L.A. this spring, and we could not be more excited for them. You know, Jordan Klepper, whose new show is launching on Comedy Central in September, and Laura Gray, whom he collaborated with on a festival project a few years ago. That's very exciting to see Jordan, you know, expanding beyond The Daily Show and taking the reins of his own project. Laura Gray is his head writer. You know, Phil and Mike, Phil Matarese and Mike Luciano from Animals, which just wrapped its second season on HBO, got greenlit for a third. So we're seeing a number of NYTVF alums and official projects continuing to find success. And I think that whether it's coming out of the festival and getting staffed in a writer's room, selling your next project, you know, I think there's two or three projects on CW Seed, which is the digital arm of the CW that is sort of a incubator for them. We have several festival projects that are there, including a great sort of crossover genre series called Saving the Human Race, which is really funny, which was a NYTVF project 3 years ago. So it's, you know, I think for us, the challenge of a television festival versus a film festival is that when you take something to Sundance, it can be sold and put in a movie theater within, you know, a few weeks or months. Television's a little bit different of a game. However, we're really seeing the fruits of these great artistic projects coming to fruition, and, you know, it's showing itself in a multitude of ways, but I think at the end of the day, it's heartening for us to see the great talent that is coming through the festival find success, find work, and find greater exposure in, you know, both the traditional television and digital landscape. So we're over the moon and can't wait to see all of those projects in their next iteration.
Incidentally, that Life Sentence pair, when they did Significant Mother, was on our program to showcase that series when it was on the CW, and we'd love to have them back when they have Life Sentence. Life Sentence being planned for mid-season on the CW. Final question before we go, Aaron. Toronto's Film Festival, one of the major ones for movies, just announced that they're taking their first television entry, and that's the new miniseries Alias Race from Netflix. Do you think at some point the New York Film Festival is going to do something in television? Right now, they have announced their film slate. They are supposed to announce the rest of their stuff very soon. Do you ever think that there might be down the road perhaps a partnership or an alliance?
You know, I would say we are always open to the discussion. And you know, as I said earlier in the conversation, I think the idea that TV is finding a home in some of these larger high-profile festivals is a good thing for everyone. You know, and our focus continues to be on this sort of this niche part of the festival culture, which is really, you know, beyond the showcase element, which is great, and we have our primetime series and we're thrilled to do it, but it's really focused on getting these great independent works in front of people who can actually make a difference for them. As long as we're able to continue doing that, we view that as a success.
One other point before we leave, Aaron, you should know that over the years, the number of entries from Brooklyn in particular has also grown. And we'll see what happens when the new class of pilots comes out next week. Hopefully there will be a lot more Brooklyn entries because Brooklyn has become sort of a mini Hollywood thanks to everything from The Americans on FX to all the Netflix Marvel shows that are produced in that there borough. The New York Television Festival. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Aaron.
Oh no, I just said absolutely, and you know, we're excited to share those official selections, and we'll certainly let you know. And you know, thank you again for having us every year, Simon. We're thrilled to do it, and congrats again to you on your anniversary.
Thank you very, very much. And let's tell everyone before you go. New York Television Festival, 13th year, October 23rd to the 27th. Check your local listings for the areas that the festival will be taking place, the screenings, and for more details about the festival, including the announcement of the pilot and the script nominees as well, here's where you go online, www.nytdf.com. That's www.nytdf.com. Erin Day, Festival Director, thank you again for being with us. Thank you and Terrence and everybody at the festival for the marvelous support you've given us over this decade and change. It has really been an honor. By the way, once again, we want to extend the invitation that when the festival completes, we would love to have some of the winners on this program. They are always welcome.
We would be thrilled to, and we'll see you in October.
For sure. Thank you, Erin. Give my best to Terrence and everybody. Take care.
Thanks, Simon. Bye.
Erin Day, head of the New York Television Festival, Festival Director, joining us live here in New York. One final time, New York TV Festival, edition 13, October 23rd and 27th. And again, www.nytdf.com. We'll have more tomorrow to be televised, but first, some words from the fine people at audible.com. And if you're in the mood for some wonderful audio listening, how about this? The Dark Tower. It's the Stephen King novel, or novel series, that now is a major hit movie and soon will become a television series. If you want to check it out anytime you like, how about this? Become a subscriber to audible.com, and we make it very easy. Just use this URL, audibletrial.com/televised. Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information. With over 180,000 titles to choose from, every genre included, you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you are hearing this on right now at Blog Talk Radio. Remember, if you sign up at audibletrial.com/televised, that's audibletrial.com/televised, you get one free audiobook and a one-month trial of the service. And great customer service because Audible is owned by Amazon.com. So hear for yourself, whether it's The Dark Tower by Stephen King, other books in that series, or anything you like, how Audible can transform the way you hear the world. That's audibletrial.com/televised. Coming up for our next half hour, the latest on TV in My Bones, which opened up on Wednesday night here at Theater for the New City in New York. We'll let you know how that crowdfunding campaign is going. We have the answer to this week's classic trivia question, and we'll let you know about the prizes we're going to be offering for next week's situation. But first, Emmy Award-winning tune composer Lira Manas will join us. A new work from her is being debuted at Carnegie Hall in October. We've got her, and we've got the conductor of that work, Amy Anderson. They will both join us. We'll hear from Los Angeles after we pause after the bottom of the hour for web identification. You are connected to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com. More than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for hygiene for health. Check it out tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, best of BTR available 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to half hour number two of Tomorrow Be Televised, second of 3 half hours, 90 minutes in all that we are with you as we wrap up week one of our second decade as the program all about television. Simon Appleman will be live from New York. Delighted to have you with us. If you have a question or comment for our guests in the hour ahead, give us a call and use this number, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. We're from our friend from Philadelphia is in the room along with guests. 8:43. Coming up for our next half hour, the latest on TV in My Bones. The off-Broadway play is open Wednesday night at Theater for the New City in Manhattan. Plus, we'll have the answer to this week's classic trivia question. But first, it's very, very rare that television composers have an opportunity to be the subject of concert performances, whether here in New York or Los Angeles or elsewhere. Some have, like John Williams, Mike Post, and when he was alive, his partner Pete Carpenter, and famous composers who did TV work like Elmer Bernstein, Bernard Herrmann, Franz Waxman, and Jerry Goldsmith. But it's even rarer that a TV tune composer gets the opportunity to have that kind of a showcase. It did happen posthumously for the wonderful Warner Brothers cartoonist Carl Sterling. And on October 7th, it's going to happen for one of the top people now in the world of TV tune composing. She started her work on such Warner Brothers series as Batman and Batman Beyond. She's been a multiple Emmy nominee, and she finally did win an Emmy, a daytime Emmy, several years ago. And the name of the work she is showcasing is called Overture to Life. It's a very personal one, and it's going to be part of a concert called Journey to America, From Repression to Freedom, at Carnegie Hall, October 7th. Joining us live in an inner radio exclusive from Los Angeles, Lolita Ridmanos. Lolita, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Simon, and happy anniversary to you.
Thank you, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you with us. And I believe also joining us live, I believe from Denver, Colorado, is the conductor of the orchestra that is going to run your work. The orchestra is called Orchestra Moderna NYC, Amy Anderson. Amy, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you great. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Okay.
Lolita,
did you ever think
that you would have the rare opportunity in the world of animated composing to do something like this?
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled. And, of course, I have to say a profound gratitude to Amy Anderson for programming my piece. As a matter of fact, I've been writing concert music parallel to my work in animation music pretty much my entire career. So I was hoping for a Carnegie Hall at some point, but the fact that it came at this point in my life is just absolutely thrilling. And, it's going to be fantastic. I mean, the program is full of amazing, amazing works. Peter Boyer has a work about Ellis Island. There's also a new violin concerto by Stephen Lebetkin, and Amy is just wonderful. So yeah, I couldn't be more happy, and I certainly hope that my animation fans come out and listen to this concert, because I swear you are not going to be sorry. It's going to be fun and melodic, and just, you know, bring your lightsabers even if you want, you know.
Amy, you're conducting a fairly new orchestra here in New York that is in part devoted to showcasing work by women and people of color. Did you off the bat have a thought about having someone like Lolita, who is known on the animation side of television, or other TV composers in prime time, let's say, to have their work featured?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you. I'm actually outside of the country. And so if you could please repeat the question, I'll answer that.
Absolutely. And where outside the country are you?
I'm in Europe. And so I'm having a little trouble hearing you. I apologize.
No problem, Amy, and I'll speak up for you. Amy, when you formed this, or when this orchestra was formed, and I understand part of the thing about this orchestra was that it would showcase new work by women and people of color. Was it your intention to try to showcase composers in television as part of that? And how did Lolita get into the picture?
Oh, yes, absolutely. My vision for this new orchestra was to be inclusive of a lot of genres, which include film and video game music and contemporary music, because that's what really what the millennials are missing in the concert experience today. And how I came about that is I was in LA doing some project work, and I met Lolita through the Alliance of Women Film Composers at a wonderful concert, and I immediately was taken just by her energy, her intelligence, her commitment to helping mentor young female composers in all genres. So I met her and I said, I need to do a project with her, and I kept her in mind, and it just sort of came together as I was putting the orchestra together. I said, I need to do a piece with Lolita, and she suggested the Overture to Light, which is a spectacular piece, beautifully composed, melodic, completely accessible, and embodies the kind of spirit that she has, which was really full of love.
Lolita, this piece is very personal. I understand that it really speaks to your heritage.
Absolutely. I am Latvian. I speak Latvian. Latvian was my first language. My parents immigrated from Latvia. They fled communism during World War II. And throughout my life growing up in Oregon, we kept the Latvian culture alive during all those years of when Latvia was occupied by part of the Soviet Union. And we sang, we wrote songs, we wrote symphonic works, we had song festivals, we demonstrated against Soviet rule and oppression. And actually the fact that Latvia was able to regain its independence was such a miracle and such an amazing thing that it still brings tears to my eyes, the fact that has happened in my lifetime, and my parents are still very much alive and well, and they are, I know, extremely extremely excited that that their daughter will have an opportunity to have her piece played at Carnegie Hall. And as a little aside, my older sister, Brigitte, actually performed a piano concerto at Carnegie Hall when she was about, 19. So, you know, it kind of comes full circle around. So it's very, very exciting.
The Lou Hermanos, the Emmy-winning TV composer of such programs as Batman, Batman Beyond, Legion Superheroes, is with us this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Her new work, Question of Light, is getting a showcase here in New York as part of Journey to America, From Repression to Freedom. It's taking place at Carnegie Hall on October 7th. And we'll tell you how you can get tickets, by the way, a little later on in the interview. We're also joined live from Europe, as it turns out, by the conductor of Orchestra Moderna, NYC, Amy Anderson. They're both with us live. The leaders from Los Angeles, right here on Tomorrow We Televise. Tom Applebaum with you live from New York on the program World Live Television on Blog Talk Radio. If you have a question or comment from both of our guests, give us a call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Numbers good anywhere. You're catching us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. It's at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televise. Gets 843, and Rick Webb, our friend from Philadelphia, is in the room. Coming up Monday on Tomorrow We Televise, we'll be joined by another TV composer. This one is getting known for being the co-composer of the score for Netflix's latest miniseries, Wet Hot American Summer, 10 years later. If you know your adult twin, you may know this person's work also from the long-running series, Children's Hospital. We're talking about Matt Novick, and he'll join us live Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, here on Tomorrow We'll Be Televised. Amy, this concert is going to be very special, not just for Lita, but also you're featuring another person's work that is also going to get a public television showcase.
Yes, that's correct. This is The Dream of America, Ellis Island, The Dream of America by Grammy-nominated composer Peter Boyer. And it's a beautiful sort of bookend to this program, which encompasses the thematic material that really runs throughout the whole program, which is the theme of immigration, which resonates with our politics of today, which is on everyone's mind, and it's a beautiful tribute to the Ellis Island immigrants in conjunction with the Ellis Island Oral History Project and the Ellis Island archival photos. And it really is, it's a beautiful tribute to people who were brave enough to leave their homelands and start in America.
Lolita, you were one of the first women to break into the music business for tunes. You did it with Warner Brothers, and you did it with a composer who also was an Emmy Award winner, who was also a groundbreaker named Shirley Walker, who a lot of more people should know about. She was probably the first female composer to make it both in animation and primetime. Did a show called The Flash, which I believe she was Emmy nominated for. What was it like for you to break in? How difficult was it, and how did Shirley help you to get into the world of tune music?
Well, I absolutely owe my career to Shirley Walker. She is very much missed. She's no longer with us, but her music absolutely lives on. She was working on several different platforms, and it's interesting that, you know, all the various separations, television composer, film composer, concert composer, video game composer, I really think that those lines are very blurred now, and we cross over to all the different genres. And Shirley absolutely had also scored feature films, and although I do not think she ever got the due that she deserved, she certainly was absolutely one of the giants of her time as far as musically speaking. She was very busy. She was working on numerous projects, and she was offered the series Batman, the animated series. And I was a very young, aspiring composer at the time, and she basically put out a call to industry professionals saying that she is willing to mentor and help young composers break into the business. So I actually, you know, to get a call from, at that point, there was a music contractor, Patty Fidelibus, who at that point, she's also no longer with us. She called me and said, "Hey, Lolita, do you have anything you want to submit? Shirley's looking for people to write on this show called Batman the Animated Series." So, of course, I almost fell off my chair, but I sent in my demo, and that was, you know, it's a beginning of a long, long story, but throughout the years, she only not only gave me the gift of really starting out my career as a composer. Prior to that, I had been doing a lot of orchestrating, and also for other giants like Michael Kamen and Basil Apollodorus and Mark Snow. But she gave me the gift of having my first television credit, and also for me to meet my my current partners, who are brilliant, Michael McQuistion and Christopher Carter. We collectively are known as Dynamic Music Partners, and we work on a lot of animated series. And it's she was just a tremendous, tremendous person, and tough as nails at times, and just fantastic. And it's actually, I owe more to her than even just my composing career, because I sort of inherited the Alliance for Women Film Composers from our founding president, Laura Karpman. She reached out to me and she said, you know, I think you're going to have to take over the presidency, because I am now one of the governors of the Motion Picture Academy. So I am currently wearing many, many hats, you know, among which are, you know, being the president of the Alliance for Women Film Composers, getting very excited to be a traveler to New York City to hear my piece at Carnegie, and as well keeping my busy career going in film composing.
There has been so much made over the last couple of years, ever since the Oscars, No Black or So Black situation, the white campaign, to try to get more women and women of color, especially into television as writers, as producers, as directors, and so on. What is the environment like now for women who want to break into the music side of the business as composers, as music directors, as arrangers, as orchestrators?
Well, it's pretty remarkable that we have so many women composers, yet when people are asked to name women composers, they pretty much stop after about two or three names. Just simply by having this Alliance for Women Film Composers, in the span of just a couple of years, our directory, we now have over 200 working women composers that are listed in our directory. And this directory is accessible online, you know, at bawfc.com. And there are scores of women doing television, doing features, many extremely talented composers that just really need to be asked to come to the party, be asked to submit their material and be considered for these larger tentpole features. We have several women working in independent film and of course television and video games, and there is absolutely no excuse and no reason for there to be any kind of discrimination or sexism or any line drawn at this point between being a woman composer or being a male composer. We are not only a mentorship through the Alliance, we are a very strong advocacy group. And we invite all of our partners at the various organizations, at the PROs, at the, you know, Comic-Con, film festivals. Just reach out to our organization if you ever want to have a woman on your panel. A woman needs to be on panels and in concerts. We definitely need more of an equal playing field. And not only just for the – it's not tokenism. It really is all about the fact that there are these – amazing voices out there that people need to hear. Amy was at the concert that the Alliance produced with Grand Performances last year, and we're coming up on the one-year anniversary of that concert, and it featured over 20 women composers, the top composers really right now working in television, film, and video games. And some of the reactions from the executives that came from the studios were quite surprising. I mean, there was one reaction that from a major studio had my manager recounted as somebody saying, "Wow, I didn't know Lolita could do that." And now that's after how many years in the business already? So just, you know, just do it. Just hire us, hire women, hire people of color. Just open the door. And your project will benefit from it tremendously. It's just, we are there. We are ready with amazing voices. So,
Amy, what is this particular concert at Carnegie Hall designed to do? This is one with a very unique theme and one dealing with an experience that is certainly in forefront of news of late. What do you hope people get from not just hearing Alita's work and Peter's work, but the conference as a whole, the concert as a whole?
Yes, what I really find is lacking in most American orchestras across the United States is they're lacking in diversity in their membership, and they're lacking in the diversity of the composers they perform, and they really don't reflect the communities where they work. And so it's part of my vision to create a diverse orchestra in the middle of New York City. There is really no diversity in the major orchestras there. To create a diverse orchestra that reflects the diversity, the beauty, the diversity of New York City, and to reach out to the community and say, come to this concert. It's culturally relevant. It's what's going on now in the culture. It's about a theme everyone is talking about. And to create a dialogue between a musical organization and a community, because oftentimes it's a one-way conversation. The orchestra performs, they do a lot of white male composers, and the orchestra isn't diverse, and a sort of one-sided demographic attends the orchestra concerts. And so my goal is to change that, to have affordable ticket prices, to encourage people to come to Carnegie Hall in T-shirts and jeans and sneakers or dress up whatever you want. You can clap between movements. Nobody's going to give you a ticket. You can cough during the quiet solos. A concert hall is for everyone, and it should be accessible emotionally and musically for everyone. So come and enjoy this music, because I'm very acutely aware of the 18 to 39-year-olds who don't go to orchestra concerts in New York City. They don't go because they're not interested in Beethoven and Brahms. And listen, that's the music I was raised and trained on. I love it. But it doesn't have as much cultural relevancy to the younger generation as it does for the older generation. So my goal is to create a game-changing orchestra that is connected to the diversity of the community, and the diversity of the community is reflected in the projects and in the music that we perform.
Another very interesting sidelight of this conference, this concert, Alita, is that it's happening during a very special time for you, more toward what you do with tunes, and that's Comic-Con.
Yeah, what an amazing synergy that is to find out. When Amy told me when the concert was going to be happening, I searched online. It's like, oh my, New York Comic Con is happening that weekend, and I know that the fans of animation are going to be, you know, I think it's the second biggest con next to San Diego, so the town will be full of animation and animation music fans and superheroes. Fans, and while this music is concert music, it is accessible, and what a great opportunity if you're going to be in New York anyway for Comic-Con, come to this concert on Saturday night. I mean, you might not be able to get into whatever screening is happening at the con, so come to the concert, and I promise you, you will not be sorry. I would love to meet you and talk about all things, you know, talk about Avengers or talk about Young Justice or Batman, Harley Quinn, whatever else, you know, I've done in the recent past, but just this concert is absolutely for you, the fans of this of superhero music, because it's again, it's not just my piece, but Peter's piece is very accessible, and it'll be a great thing. It'll be a great thing to put in your resume as far as, you know, places you've been as part of Comic-Con. Carnegie Hall, why not, right?
Yeah, why not? And why not, for example, maybe down the road, not too far down the road, have this orchestra, Amy, and Alita jump in here, maybe do an all-female composer for television event where all the pieces are female composers or female composers of color working in television.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I mean, my big drive is to be very inclusive of women and minority composers, give them a format and a place to shine, to share, So people really say, oh, my gosh, I had no idea there was so much talent out there that we really haven't been given access to, particularly since L.A. seems so far away in a lot of ways with the film business out there. I wanted to bring it to the East Coast, really firmly in the middle of New York City and Carnegie Hall. And those are the kind of projects that I'm already dreaming up. And in addition to doing a commission with an African-American composer for a major symphonic piece. That's one of my near and dear to my heart goals now, is to do a major work with an African-American composer, which it's a rarity. That also needs to be done.
Louisa, by the way, is there a woman composer in television that you're very high on, who's new on the scene that you would like to see get more exposure? And for what show is this person doing?
Well, there's so many women composers working. I think the fact that Laura Cartman didn't get an Emmy nomination for her work on Underground is a little bit of an interesting question in my mind, but certainly support Laura and Catherine Bostick, Nora Kroll Rosenbaum, Star Parodi. I mean, I can start listing and listing and listing, and we'll be here all day. Please look at the Alliance for Women Film Composers website, and you can start reading about all these women, and you will be floored at what talent is out there and what some of these women are just amazingly accomplished. And I did want to say one little interesting thing that I've noticed, and I don't really understand it. I mean, we are a country of immigrants. We are the land of opportunity. But it seems like it is much easier and much more prevalent to have works performed by women and by people of color in Europe, in other parts of the world. And I know as a Latvian, the accessibility I have had throughout my life for the concert stage, I mean, this work received its European premiere actually in Latvia, and so this will be its U.S. premiere. But it was basically a thing where I was approached by the World Latvian Association to write a opening piece for a big concert that would be performed by the Jazza Pietola's Academy of Music Orchestra, and it was just it was very thrilling. But it's common. It's common to have women composers and people of color being performed in Europe. And so, you know, America, let's get with it and let's open the door and more opportunities for all different voices to be heard.
Yeah. I totally understand. By the way, speaking of Underground, I did not know Laura. I'm familiar with some of Laura's work. I did not know she was doing Underground, because we've covered that show, and I think that's one of a number of nominations, Emmy nominations, that program should have received, including one for Aisha Hines' performance as Harriet Tubman, with one of the great hours of television all year long, the hour where Harriet speaks to the white abolitionist for a full hour. It's one of the most amazing hours of TV you'll ever see. Anthony Hemingway should have been nominated for directing that segment. And so should Misha Green, Joe Pasarka, the writers and creators of the show, for sensational work, and Aisha Hines and Laura. I totally agree with you. And by the way, I know who Star Parodi is. She was the original one of the people in the band for Arsenio Hall's show. Did not know
absolutely.
She was still in television. No.
Yeah.
Way to go. Absolutely. I wish we could keep this conversation going, because this has been so much fun and a real pleasure and very, very enlightening for, I think, definitely just me, for our audience. And we got to continue at some point. But I do want to let everybody know that Journey to America, From Repression to Freedom, that's the concert from the new orchestra of Costa Moderna NYC. It'll be running Carnegie Hall on Saturday, October 7th. You can get tickets, by the way, through this website, www.orchestramodernanyc.com. That's www.orchestramodernanyc.com. Check it out. Happening during Comic-Con time, and it should be a really great, great, not just a wonderful concert to itself, but hopefully the beginning of showcasing more women TV and film composers here in the New York area and elsewhere across the country. Louisa Romanos, Emmy winner, thank you again for joining us. It's been a fantastic pleasure having you aboard. Amy Anderson, joining us live from Europe, the conductor of Orchestra Moderna. Good luck with this concert, and hopefully much, much more coming. Also, good luck with the PBS special featuring Peter Ellis' work, Ellis Island. And again, thank you both for coming on the program. We really appreciate it. And Louisa, we would love to have more women composers on our program. So
Hey, let's do it. Let's do it. Let's make it a regular, regular series.
You got it, Alita. Your lips and everyone's ears. Take care, both of you, and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you,
Thank
Simon.
Thank you so very much. Take care, both of you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lavina Hermanos from Los Angeles and Amy Anderson from Orquesta Moderna joining us live from Europe. This half hour on Tomorrow will be televised. When we come back, our classic trivia question of the week, The Up on TV in My Bones, which premiered this past Wednesday at Theater for the New City. We'll give you an update on the crowdfunding campaign and what yours truly will be doing with that play tomorrow afternoon. But first, we'll showcase an entrepreneur who's trying to get more digital programming on smart TV sets and devices through platforms such as YouTube Red. The founder of Select, that's Scott Fisher, joins me next from Los Angeles after we pause for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, where there's 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for the Falcon Forum. Check it out Sunday, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, only on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, best speaks are available 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the Marvel Televised. Welcome to those of you just joining us at the top of the hour for the program on television, wrapping up week one of its second decade on the air. Simon Appleband with you live from the Big Apple, 80 degrees at the top of the hour. Another great guest coming your way in this half hour ahead. And we invite you to be part of the program. All it takes to ring from you, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number's going anywhere. You'll catch us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio. And check out our chat room, Simon Apple 04. My name, guest 843, and Rick Lauer, our friend from Philadelphia, is in the room. We started the beginning of our second decade on the air showcasing an entrepreneur in a new role, Katie O'Connor Marsh. She was the former head of Gaumont Television that produced such shows as Hannibal for NBC and Narcos, going into its third season, next month on Netflix. She's now heading a brand new production studio devoted to scripted television. It's called Platform One Media, formed by TPG and Liberty Global, the international cable operator. Well, we're going to wrap up this week with another entrepreneur story, this one featuring an entrepreneur of a company called Select that in part is out to get people in digital programming a home on television through smart TV sets and smart devices through such platforms as YouTube Red. And two of those YouTube Red specials are getting a lot of traction. One is a movie called Me and My Grandma. The other is a critically acclaimed special, This Is Everything, GG Gorgeous. Joining us live from Los Angeles, an internet radio system, the founder of Select, Scott Fisher. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Tell us what Select's all about and why you formed it.
Yeah, so Select is two things. One is a talent management company working with digital stars in the same way our traditional management company, you know, has done for years. And the other half of the business is production, investing in ventures with talent, creating bigger businesses outside of, you know, the management relationship.
A lot of digital stars, specifically YouTube stars, are now having big horizons in television, whether they want to be celebrities on individual shows, headline their own programs, or use projects like YouTube Red or the YouTube commercial-supported shows, like, for example, Kevin Hart's new show with his new service, Laugh Out Loud, and Lionsgate is distributing. Is there sort of a unique formula you've developed to have that happen? What is the road like to have someone like Gigi Gorgeous, for example, get some exposure on television?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different for everybody. So some clients, they don't even see television as the next step or the next thing they need to be doing. They actually see it as the kind of old school way, and they would prefer to have their series on YouTube Red, whereas others, you know, they've always wanted to be a TV star, so they're kind of, their end game is just being on television. Most of our clients are in the first bucket, though, where they own their audience on YouTube, and they can create whatever they want, whenever they want, so anything else they do needs to kind of be in that same vein. So for someone like Gigi with the documentary, this was something that she wanted to have a story told in a very specific way and have the resources, you know, that she didn't necessarily have on her own. So we took the project out to a bunch of different buyers, and we ended up choosing YouTube Red because they were kind of, the most, you know, we knew they would support Gigi because she's been on the platform for, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. And they would market it in a really powerful way. They had an amazing out-of-home campaign. They played, you know, the trailer as a commercial during the Oscars. They really got behind the project.
In a way, this venture couldn't have been formed at a better time because, as we've been saying the last couple of weeks, we now know that about 60%, actually more than 60% of all U.S. households now are watching TV through smart TV sets by the likes of Samsung, LG, Vizio, Sharp, Panasonic, etc., as well as devices connected to the set like Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Google Chromecast, Apple TV, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The usage is growing. How many days of a month there is growing? And it's no secret why, whether it's Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or YouTube Red, the set has become the way to watch.
Exactly. And I personally have a full cable package, but I don't think I've actually used it in months because even if I'm watching a network show, I'm probably just watching it on Hulu on my Apple TV just because that's kind of where I already am. So that for me has changed. And then for Gen Z, it's like that's not even a part of their mindset anymore. It's all on their smartphone and sometimes on the smart TV.
When you deal with someone like Suzanne Daniels, the former Lifetime president, who is the head of YouTube Red, and you are pitching them on showcasing a YouTube star like Gigi Gorgeous this way, or this YouTube star in a scripted series, as opposed to a lifestyle series, like Hannah Hart, for example, who's about to start a new series with Food Network, her first. How difficult a pitch is it, even when you're approaching a part of YouTube? Are there certain things you've learned that you have to emphasize in the pitch that will foster appetite in going forward with a project?
Yeah, I think one big credit we give them is that they're not just buying a project because there's a YouTube star attached. That would have been, you know, the easy thing to do for them, but they're really buying projects that actually have, you know, meaning, some meat on its bones, so to speak, and things like Gigi's documentary, that was a huge emotional story that had to be told in a really delicate way. And throughout the whole process, they were really, really careful to, you know, look at it with that lens rather than just, you know, let's get this YouTube star project out as soon as possible just to kind of hit whatever quotas we needed to hit. So they've been good, and they've been looking at things from a creative perspective, and they're not just buying something because, you know, the star has millions of followers, which is really, you know, a positive for me.
We're speaking with Scott Fisher. He's the entrepreneur behind Select, an organization that's out to showcase digital stars in the very unique ways, possibly through smart TV sets and smart devices. And it's through those devices that YouTube Red has two projects in particular that Select has been championing, the made-for-TV movie Me and My Grandma and the popular documentary This Is Everything, Gigi Gorgeous. Scott joins us live from Los Angeles this half hour on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon Appleband with you live from wherever you are. You have a question or comment for Scott? Don't be shy. Raise that voice and pick up the phone for this number, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Our friend Rick Webb from Philadelphia is still in the room. One week from today on Tomorrow Will Be Televised, we'll have Neil Reagan. He's one of the key executives of Travel Channel. He's also the executive producer of one of their new series coming out later this month. It's Caribbean Pirate Treasures. It features the son of the great undersea explorer, Jacques Cousteau, Philippe Cousteau. And then for our first time ever, we're going to showcase a very unique side of television we rarely see, the world of the news cameraman, somebody who has been for four decades on the front line from Vietnam to 9/11 for ABC News. His name is Tony Hirschicki. He's just co-written with Terry Irvin a new book called On the Front Line of the Television War. Terry and Tony will both be with us, and we will offer that book as one of our prizes next week in our Classic Trivia section. By the way, we'll be answering this week's Classic Trivia question a little bit later on. How many projects do you work on at the same time at Select?
So we have about 30 clients in total that we service on the management side, and at any time, you know, they can have a handful of different projects that they're all working on. So if you kind of look at that as the big picture, it could be hundreds. And then on the production side, it's more when we see something that we're super passionate about, our client is passionate about, and we want to help them make it happen. So we have a bunch of things in development right now, but we're not looking at it like, you know, we need to have an output of 50 projects a year or anything like that. It's kind of as we get excited about them.
We started today's program with Aaron Day of the New York Television Festival. You have television festivals now all over the country, New York, Chicago, Long Island, ITVF in Manchester, Vermont, ATB in Atlanta, ATX in Austin, Texas. You've got Sundance and Tribeca now doing more time with television. Toronto's International Film Festival just got their first major TV entry in Alias Grace, the miniseries coming up from Netflix. Are you encouraging your clients to try television pilots and show them at festivals like New York?
Yeah, I mean, whenever it came up, I would totally be open to that. I love the idea of the community that comes around a festival, being at Sundance, actually having a project there for the first time this year was such an amazing experience. And I think everyone being together and celebrating what they're working on and kind of seeing everything for the first time is a huge positive.
What project was that, Scott?
It was Gigi Gorgeous, the This Is Everything, the documentary that premiered at Sundance with our director, Barbara Koppel.
Barbara was on our program when she did a wonderful documentary about Mariel Hemingway and her dealing with mental illness. What was it like
Amazing. Working
with Barbara, one of the great documentarians of all time?
Everything everyone has said about her, it doesn't even, you know, touch the surface. She is a genius, and she cares so much about what she's doing. She's a true artist, and she, you know, and I love that eccentric, you know, just every day is a different journey with her. And her getting to kind of experience Gigi's world for the first time, and to watch her meet everyone in Gigi's life and meet us and kind of hear everything that's gone on over the past 6 years or so, was amazing. And she just has such an eye to kind of cut through, you know, to the truth and kind of tell the audience and show them what they really need to see, and not kind of the fluff that everyone else might choose to show.
Now, on a different side of the coin, you had Me and My Grandma, which was a YouTube-read, made-for-TV movie. What was it like putting that together? How did that come about?
Yeah, so it was actually a half-hour comedy, six episodes, and it kind of stemmed from Ava, our other client, always telling us about her stories growing up with her grandma. So her grandma would take her to school, her grandma would, you know, get her ready to go on a date. Even in college, she would always be just hanging out with her grandma, having fun. So we said, why don't we do a show inspired by this? So we kind of put together a concept where, you know, Janie, who is kind of a girl kind of loosely inspired by Ava, decides to move to Los Angeles with her grandmother to become an actress. And then it kind of turns out that the grandma is the one that gets the attention from everyone out here. And then we actually brought on Rhea Perlman of Cheers, of course, you know, that other legend. And, you know, they had such great chemistry, and it was a great experience.
How long does it take for that chemistry to come together, especially when you have someone who is so iconic for a series like Cheers, like Rhea?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, we just sent them to brunch together on a Sunday morning, and they hit it off. We got texts from both of them saying they had the best time, and they just clicked automatically. And I think Rhea saw something in Ava, being, you know, Rhea's a total professional, and kind of saw in Ava that glimmer of something, and just really believed in her and the project and was fully supportive.
Mm-hmm. How did you try to get the notice of critics and journalists in Me and My Grandma, given the fact that where it came from was YouTube Red? And so far, YouTube Red has not had, compared to some of the other platforms like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, has not had as much attention given to it at times, or not as much publicity in terms of reviews, let's say from the likes of Variety, Hollywood Reporter, local papers, Entertainment Weekly, and so on.
I mean, I think between Grandma and This Is Everything, them bringing on that, you know, traditional high-profile talent in Rhea and in Barbara, I think helped them place a stake in the landscape that's going on. We got great press on both, and the press has been super supportive. But obviously it's an uphill battle. It takes everyone a while to kind of reach that point of critical mass. But I think YouTube Red is getting behind a lot of kind of visionary, traditional, you know, established figures, and then also bringing in someone like Ava or Gigi, who are obviously young and have something there and supporting them.
Mm-hmm. Any word whether we will see additional episodes?
Not yet, but we will keep you in the loop.
Great. And incidentally, for the very first time, YouTube Red spoke at the TV Critics Tour, the summer tour in Los Angeles, which wrapped up yesterday. We're speaking with entrepreneur Scott Fisher. His company, Select, gets YouTube and other digital programming stars and tries to make the new frontiers, in part through smart TV sets and smart devices and services that those devices can reach for you, like YouTube Red. He joins us live from Los Angeles this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon Applebaum with you live from the Big Apple, 80 degrees at the top of the hour. Happy you're with us as we wrap up week one of our second decade on the air. And if you have a question or comment for Scott, like we say, don't be shy. We want to have you be interactive in the conversation. All it takes is using 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Coming up on August 21st, we have another very eclectic show for you. There's a brand new venture coming out in October, also that will be available on smart TV sets and devices from Warner Brothers called Stage 13. It's bringing together short form and maybe ultimately long form episodic content featuring people and women of color. We will have the head of Stage 13, Diana Margolon, formerly the head of Mundos, now known as Universo, and we'll also have Warner Brothers executive Christopher Mack. Also on the program, we'll have a general manager of one of the fast-rising information services available on smart TV sets, and also on the New York cable channels, the general manager of Newsy, Blake Sabatelli. And also, we'll meet a former contestant on The Voice and hear what she is up to through a brand-new Netflix film called Anastasia, Once Upon a Time. Her name is Aaliyah. You'll meet her. That's coming up on August 21st. Right here, night edition on Tomorrow Will Be Televised, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. Are there other platforms besides YouTube Red that you would like to explore, like Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and the like?
Yeah, we've obviously had discussions with all of them, and we have some projects coming up, you know, either where we're producing or our talent is, you know, talent for hire for a bigger deal. Open to those and supportive of all of them. I think every one of them has their own thing and their kind of own approach, but I think everyone's doing what they should be doing for themselves in the right way.
What do you think about Apple and Facebook getting in as players? Apple as a programmer, maybe more. We know, of course, Apple TV with apps. Mm-hmm. Carpool Karaoke, their latest series, and their second series premiered this past Tuesday. And now you have Facebook with Watch, which sounds like it wants to be sort of their own Netflix, starting with short-form content, but ultimately they want to either produce or encourage long-form, half-hours, and hour shows.
Yeah, I mean, I think Facebook, obviously, it's been in the conversation for a long time about them really getting into video, and they've been careful to just build up the kind of UGC video business, I guess, on their side without even monetizing it to start. And they really did show that the eyeballs are there. So I have big faith in them to execute originals. I think that's obviously a conversation that we're happy to have for sure. And then on the Apple side, they're a behemoth. There's no arguing that they won't have success. They're still in their early stages, though. I think it's tough sometimes to find the originals on the Apple Music platform because it's kind of fragmented, but I think, you know, they're not necessarily doing a really, really hard push right now. I think they'll move into that soon.
Mm-hmm. One area that some services are now attempting to tap is podcasts. Amazon has a deal with Julia Roberts to do 2 seasons of Homecoming, which is based on the very popular podcast of the same name. Sam Esmail, the creator of Mr. Robot, is going to be developing that. We know there are some other podcasts out there that are either in active development or may very soon be announced. What do you think about this idea of turning podcasts into television shows?
I love it. I think it's like any other medium, you know, books, plays, all of those kinds of things translating into a show or a film. I think, you know, wherever you can find a good story or good content or even just good inspiration, you should use it.
Mm-hmm. Any podcasts in development where you are?
Yeah, we have a few clients that are working on podcasts, and what they do lends so perfectly to podcasts because a lot of them are kind of, they kind of have their own talk show essentially on YouTube. So giving a little bit more of a format to it and turning it into a podcast makes sense. And a lot of the top podcasts right now are actually from, I'm sure as you know, from YouTube stars.
Finally, we talked earlier in this program about the efforts to try to bring more women of color, more people of color, the gay, lesbian, transgender community, et cetera, into television. And we're certainly seeing that. As I mentioned, there was more discussion at the Television Critics Tour the last 2 weeks in Los Angeles about the subject than ever. 3 or 4 panels on the topic, including one that was on the last day that FX did, thanks to Ryan Murphy, his HAP initiative, which is now over a year old, trying to get women directors, women of color directors on half of the assignments that he has with his programs and doing a lot more than that. The NBC Female Forward Project, more women actresses, people like Viola Davis and Gina Rodriguez to America Ferrari, who has their own production companies, and on and on. Is there anything that your organization is out to do or plan to do in the near future to try to stimulate this expansion of involvement with television?
Yeah, that's one of the most important things for me, to be totally honest. Most of our clients are female. Most of our employees at our company are female. Most of my friends are female. My whole life is just about being around powerful women and supporting women, people of color, LGBT, all of that stuff. To me, I wish it wasn't even something we had to talk about. I wish it was just, you know, across the board, but it's important. And I see my job a lot of the time is empowering female entrepreneurs. Our clients, they all own their own businesses. They're all kind of employing their own teams, and wherever we can influence that, I think it's our responsibility to, because, you know, if we don't make a change, you know, who knows who else will. So it's always top of mind for us.
We're going to take a call before we go, and here it is. Hello, you're on Smart with Televised. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, Simon. It's Rick Webb from Philadelphia.
Rick, delighted you're with us. Go right ahead.
Hey, Scott. I know you do a lot of, like, client relationships, and, like, I'm guessing that you put a lot of your clients I see in your bio, like Ralph Lauren and Walgreens and Kmart and L'Oreal, together with your clients that you now manage. My question is, like, clients that aren't, like, squeaky clean, like comedians that do, like, dirty jokes and people like that, or, like, professional wrestlers or anyone like that, like, a lot of YouTube has taken away monetization of anything it deems offensive. Like, how would you work with someone like that, like a comedian who might be deemed offensive towards getting client relationships and being able to monetize, even though Facebook has demonetized a lot of those videos?
Yeah, good question. I mean, it depends on the brand. So obviously, you're not going to have, you know, Huggies working with a client that talks about, you know, inappropriate things that aren't safe for families. But there are some brands that really do want to take risks, and they want someone that has, you know, that off the beaten path point of view. So in general, I don't represent anyone that, you know, I don't stand behind and I think has, you know, something that's actually offensive or inappropriate. With things like swearing, sometimes YouTube will demonetize, but a lot of the creators that had that would either just, you know, choose to swear less or bleep, you know, whatever they ended up doing. But I would say most of our clients aren't necessarily squeaky clean, but they're definitely kind of cable TV, you know, they're not going on any crazy rants or anything like that. And then it just depends on the talent, you know. Not all of them want to have to change how they act and what they say just to kind of, you know, monetize their talent. So it's kind of like traditional entertainment. They, you know, everyone's different and everyone kind of has different career goals, and our job is to help the talent kind of navigate who they want to be and where they want to take it.
Well, if you had the next Dave Chappelle, what do you do with them then? He refuses to stop cursing and changes. But Dave Chappelle was one of the biggest people on television. So, like, how would you work with him?
Yeah, and I don't think someone like that in this generation needs to change, because obviously Dave Chappelle had a huge had, you know, a huge career. So it's not about changing what they do. I think it's just about finding the right partners for them. So finding the right platform that believes in them and wants to get behind them, or the right brand. You know, it's just about defining who you are and standing true in that. Otherwise, you'll kind of be pushed around and you'll become this kind of like carbon copy Frankenstein version of what you actually would have been.
Ray, we got to run. Rick Robach from Philadelphia, thank you so much for the call. Have a super weekend. And if you want more details about Scott's company and what they're up to when it comes to programming for smart TV sets and smart devices on platforms like YouTube Red, here's where you go online, select.co. That's select, S-E-L-E-C-T.co. Scott, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you aboard. We'd like to cover more of your programs as they get into the TV world, and have yourself a fantastic weekend.
Thanks a lot. You too.
All right, take care. Scott Fisher from Select joining us live from Los Angeles here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Now the answer to this week's classic trivia question, no winner, so unfortunately no Disney Junior collection of wonderful magnets. The question was this. We posted on Monday and on Wednesday special episode. Name a television series starring or co-starring Jack Lemmon's son, Chris Lemmon. There were three answers. Two of them were on Fox. Duet. In 1986, then 2 years later, Open House, that was the show he did with his duet co-star, Alex LaPaca, and finally, that show he starred with Hulk Hogan, Thunder in Paradise, for syndication. Duet, Open House, Thunder in Paradise, that were our three answers for this week's classic trivia question. Sorry nobody got the answer, but next week, in addition to offering that prize, the Disney Junior Magnet, we will also be offering a free copy of the brand new book on the front lines of the television war. And we will have the authors of that program on next Friday's Tomorrow We Televise. So check out our classic trivia question on Monday afternoon. If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. simonapple04@yahoo.com. Please include your name and your mailing address. And finally, a quick follow-up, or up as we like to say, on TV In My Bones. That is the off-Broadway play that opened, and it opened very well this past Wednesday. It will have more performances tonight, tomorrow afternoon, evening, and wrapping up on Sunday afternoon. Over at Theater for the New City, 155 First Avenue between 9th and 10th Street. The latest on a crowdfunding campaign with 9 days to go, more than $6,300 has been raised, over 80% of the goal of $8,000, 9 days to go. If you want more details, want to get tickets for TV In My Bones, go to www.theaterforthenewcity.net. I'll be at the performance on Saturday afternoon. I'll be conducting an after-performance chat with the audience, with the cast, and with the playwright C.S. Hansen. If you're in the New York area, stop in and see the play at Theater for the New City and join me as well afterward. Again, coming up on Monday's episode, we will have the composer of Children's Hospital, the co-composer of the new Netflix series, West Hot American Summer, 10 years later, Matt Novak. That's 3:10 Eastern New Pacific right here on Tomorrow We Televise. Once again, thank you to all of our guests for making our first week of decade number two so super. If you came in late on today's episode, want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out the podcast version on iTunes.com and Apple TV's iTunes podcast app. And we'd love to hear from you. Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. Find me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter at UBCSimonTWBT. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not those of Block Talk Radio. Our production associate is Candace Williams. Andy Toews, Block Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Steinberg, executive content producer. The co-founders, Alan Levy and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow We Televise is brought to you today by Audible.com and Amazon Company. Audible will transform the way you hear the world. For Tomorrow We Televise, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. Have a fantastic weekend. Back Monday to start week number two of decade number two. Same time as always, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio. Have a great super weekend. Be safe and great out there. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.